look at that guy, the flag of working people, to be the light of darkness, it's all double A.
So we just recorded ourselves taking selfies. That's
first time ever in a live podcast.
Quote-unquote live podcast. Check.
I hear you.
Whoa. That was weird. Hello? You hear me okay?
I hear you fine. By the way, that was a KGB moment back there when you're like, we're recording right now. I'm like, what?
I think... So what is with your fascination with the Soviet Union? The Soviet Russia. Mother Russia.
I'm probably, what, 10 years older than you? I'm 47.
Yeah, because I'm 39.
Yeah. So when I grew up, primarily in the 70s, you know, Cold War was in full swing. And I just remember being obsessed with, you know, the Russians and the U.S. versus Russia, more properly the USSR. And
is this because you saw Red Dawn too many times?
No, this was way before Red Dawn. That was in the 80s.
Yeah, 83. I know exactly when it was.
Whatever. And... But, and I played G.I. Joes, and it was just, that was just like, that was front of mind for me and I think my generation, I assume. And, it's just what you think about, and you grow up with, you know, stories about the Cuban Missile Crisis and all these confrontations. And, you know, by 1980 we had Afghanistan and, just the whole Cold War thing, the standoffs. And, it just seemed like the whole future was this attempt primarily by, you know, our government to keep us from being nuked by the Russians. And that was just my impression.
No. Yeah. I think even being 10 years your junior or 8 years your junior,
yeah.
I think I felt that too. I remember like the day Chernobyl happened, and I remember it because, you know what, let's start the show and then we'll actually talk about that. We'll talk about Chernobyl today.
Welcome, David.
Welcome.
Welcome to your podcast.
Hi, Mickey. Thank you for having me. Welcome to another episode of 3 and 2 and 1. My name is David Gilanders. I'm the host of this podcast here from my garage in Old Town Orange, California. And Ezra is here. Ezra the dog is running around somewhere. He really likes Mickey. He ate part of Mickey's shoes earlier. Mickey is our guest this month. Mickey Vukovic. Mickey is, I will say, Mickey... I'm 39, and so I've met a lot of people in my life, and I would hazard to guess that Mickey is one of the more thoughtful, brighter people I've ever known. And so when I started doing this podcast and he and I started talking about it, I was really, really excited at the idea to have him on, and he was pretty excited to be on. So hi, Mickey.
Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Pretty good.
So where were you when Chernobyl happened?
When Chernobyl happened, I was at college in Santa Barbara, California.
Yeah, you are old.
And I was contemplating transferring to UC San Diego, where I took up Soviet studies as one of my minors.
Really?
And in 1990, traveled to the USSR to study. And ironically, this was 2 years after Chernobyl.
Yeah.
They had a bunch of like excursions and cultural things they wanted to expose us to. And one of the things they wanted to expose us to...
Well, Chernobyl was 86.
I think. Was it 88?
I think it was 86.
86, okay. So right then I would have been, starting college in Santa Barbara. But so 1990, so right a few years later, I'm in USSR.
Glasnost.
Yeah, Glasnost, right? I was really excited about Glasnost because I thought, oh, great, we can go there, we can talk about stuff. And I went to like a book sale, and I found... George Orwell's Animal Farm.
No way.
And 1984.
Holy smokes.
In Russian.
In Russian?
In Russian.
Translated.
Yeah. So it was published in Tallinn, which is the capital of Estonia, but at the time was one of the Soviet republics. And I was really excited because I think it's probably the first time that was ever
Holy
published
Christ.
Over there on Soviet. This is still in the USSR. To me, that was a big, big turning point. But one of these cultural excursions they had set up for us was... We drove like 2 or 3 hours on this bus outside of Leningrad and went through this forest, and all of a sudden it clears into this little village, and adjacent to the village is this nuclear power plant.
What?
Yeah, the Leningrad Atomic Nuclear Power Plant. You know,
did it have a statue of Lenin outside?
Yes, it
or
did.
Stalin?
No, the town did. They got us off the bus and we walked into this thing and I'm like, what? They gave us all these white smocks and these like hats and everything.
Holy crap! How old were you?
21.
So you have good memories of this. Like,
And you know, I was just fascinated by everything. So I was like, oh my God, we're in a nuclear power facility in USSR. And they were really eager to show us around. Like, and you know, I realized, first of all, after going through the control room, like where they, you know, they have all the dials and the gadgets and the knobs and stuff that they, you know, manage the thing. It was like the whole console was like this, like teal blue, you know, like steel plate kind of thing.
Sure.
And all these dials and knobs were like Art Deco style. And they, like all the gauges were needles. Like this thing was straight out of the 30s. It looked like, and I'm like, this is what's managing the nuclear rods and the, you know, the output of this station. And
in a sense, it was keeping you alive at that particular moment.
But I'm like thinking like this is pretty archaic, you know? And I'm like, I hope these people are pretty competent. These things actually work and they know what's going on. And then they made the point toward the end of the tour, to tell us that this was the exact model of a power plant as Chernobyl.
Whoa.
And look how safe it is. That was their point of this. And now go back to America and tell everybody how wonderful.
Spread the word.
And I'm like, oh, that's what this is about. You know, and there weren't a lot of American students there at the time.
I believe it's known as propaganda.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. I'm being used as an instrument.
No, man.
Of the state. So I realized that they were hoping to, you know, have us go back and tell all the Western media what, you know.
So cool.
I mean, you know, like I ever got a call from a reporter about my student
21-year-old Mickey Bukovich from Cupertino. So let's talk to him about his experience.
Yeah, so that was fascinating.
Russian missile silo. Hey, how do we know each other?
Yeah, so, you know, we haven't seen each other in about 15 years.
I was wondering about that. How we can figure that out as we kind of deduce from the story of how we know each other. So how does that go?
So, in like 2001, I took a job after being at Transworld Skateboarding Magazine for 15 years.
What did you do at Transworld?
I was an editor and photographer, and I edited the business magazine, skateboarding business magazine, Trade Journal. But I took the job with On Video, which was kind of a newer project through 411 Video Productions, and it was a skateboarding documentary series videos, which was really fascinating. The crew had done a great job, and they asked me to come along and help develop stories and produce. And it was a bit of a stretch, you know. I was doing magazine work before that, but I thought that's a really, really great way.
It's kind of analogous, or it was.
It was just a different way of storytelling. Yeah. And I was in the group. The crew was awesome. Kirk and Doug and Wing and you and BG and the whole crew. You know, it was just really, really cool. So it was a great opportunity and took it. And so we were there together and you were doing music rights.
Yeah, music stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And then helping out with some marketing stuff with BG and stuff.
Yeah. And I remember at one point we started doing some retro projects and any skateboarders out there would remember the Blind Video Days video from, I think, 1990, 91.
I think 90 is Video Days.
Mark Gonzalez, Jason Lee, who, you know, famous actor now. And a bunch of great skaters, directed by Spike Jonze, obviously a lot well known for his movies. But so we got all the people together who all kind of claimed to own the thing.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a dispute, and we worked out a deal to, you know, for them all to agree on a profit share, and we were going to reissue it when, of course, the original didn't have any music rights cleared, and so you did the legwork to secure the music rights.
How far we got on that thing,
I want to say we got that all done because we were ready to go, and then the partnership kind of fell apart, and some certain people didn't want to. It just didn't come together at the end.
Yeah.
But you managed to get Michael Jackson rights. You managed to get.
I don't even remember, honestly.
Yeah,
honestly,
through Sony. I remember that.
So
that
much
was
has
big
changed
one.
In my life since then.
Yeah.
That that seems like a previous life in a lot of ways.
It is for me too. But I just remember like that particular project. It was like so profound how it came together and the fact that you were able to, because that was the big stumbling block, is that it was put out pirate before, and none of the music
John
was cleared.
John Coltrane was on there too.
John Coltrane, and you managed to get the rights to, from all those different artists
and
or companies, and didn't come together. And
now you can watch it on YouTube for free, so it doesn't really matter.
Right. Anyways, anyone out there, there could have been a really cool release of that. So that was that, and we worked together, and it was fun, you know.
And when did you leave?
I was there about 2 years, so
2003.
I think 2004, early 2004.
And I got fired, because of the buyout.
Wasserman, yeah. So I left on a Friday. The Monday after I left, the Wasserman Media Group announced that they had bought 411 Productions.
So you knew it was coming.
I didn't. I absolutely did not. What happened was I was there and I announced that I was going to be leaving for maybe a month, even maybe 2 months before. Just so they had noticed, and then
I do remember.
So they had a bunch of meetings, and I think they just didn't, you know, figure like I didn't really need to know, and it was fine. I didn't actually need to know. So I
hung on for a while, and then came back and did some work for them when they switched over, and then that was it.
So
that was good for me because that whole thing was that was my impetus to go back to school and to kind of change what I was doing completely because I really was never happy doing any of that stuff. So.
Yeah,
I liked a lot of the people, but I mean, that's, you know, it was what it was, I guess.
Yeah, so.
So that's how we know each other. So it's been 13 freaking years. And then we reconnected, what, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, we started connecting on
Instagram.
On cyclist Instagram, which is called Strava.
Yeah. Was it Strava first?
Maybe, one or the other. And realized we were both racing bicycles in the dirt, which, you know, isn't something that people around here do.
It's kind of an automatic connection between people in a lot of ways.
It's weird. It's like, what, you're doing that? I'm doing that. I didn't think anybody else did that. Okay.
Yeah. No one else from my past life did that. At least. Yeah.
But since then, I've actually run into quite a few people from my other life, my skateboarding life, and it's fascinating.
You know? So we're going to have three topics on the show today. So we're going to talk about skateboarding. So we are going to talk about that. And we'll probably end up getting into a little bit about cycling now and how it relates and is analogous to skateboarding. We're going to talk about midlife crises. I don't know, because that's always fun, and Mick's got a big grin on his face. And then 21st century life, digital versus analog. Like, what's that like, especially for a photographer who's moved through all of that and been pretty well known for his work in photography? I mean, that is really, if you think about skateboarding and you, I mean, you became first really well known because of your photography, right?
Yeah, I definitely didn't get well known for my skateboarding. I tried, you know, like most kids, and managed to, you know, do some amateur contests and place second place a bunch. I was, you know.
And you're still skateboarding now.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because I skateboard right now exactly as I did when I was 15. You know, like,
what does that mean?
It means I kind of hit some sort of apex at that time and just been cruising.
You've been peaking for 32 years?
Yeah. I've been on my constant peak, or lull, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, like I never had the pressure. Once I realized, you know, I'm not going to be a sponsor skater, but all my friends were. So I got the benefits. So they would, you know, get boards and stuff and ride them for 2 weeks. And then I would get hand-me-downs that were perfectly broken in.
Who were some of your friends back then?
Like Owen Nieder, Tony Hawk, and, you know, Grant Britton ran. He was the manager of the skate park.
Owen Nieder, man.
Yeah.
So cool.
Adrian Demain. And
Adrian?
Yeah.
So right.
The crew, Gary Davis. So
GSD?
Yeah.
Wow. So speaking of, one name in there in particular pops out to me, Tony Hawk. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing now?
Yeah. So after 411, it was actually while I was there, Tony called me and his brother called me, and they were, you know, I've been working with them on the Tony Hawk Foundation, which he started in 2002. And his goal was to help communities build public skateboard parks. And I'd done that for a bit with the magazine, you know, the decade prior. And so I jumped in and helped develop some of the early materials and teaching communities how to go through, you know, go to City Hall and deal with the politics of getting some change made in their communities, and helping them introduce skateboarding to people who probably had a pretty negative view of it, and turning that around. So I was on the board of directors for the foundation at the time when it started. And so in 2004, Steve Hawk, who's Tony's brother, was the original director, staff director, and he was leaving to go back to writing. He was editor of Surfer Magazine previously, and they asked me to take his place. So I was like, yeah, that sounds amazing, you know.
Did you know what you were getting into?
No, but it's something, you know, I've been passionate about my whole life, and Obviously something I'd been very familiar with having been on the board. So I was willing to, just kind of do what I needed to do to learn. And, we had a couple of staff. The whole staff was three people, but, they'd been doing it. And our development director, Kim Novick, she's been a nonprofit for a long, long time. And, had a lot of great experience and was able to, really help me a lot in the beginning and kind of get everything rolling. And, we're now up to seven people.
Yeah.
So, we're not huge, but,
We both came around to working in nonprofits.
Yeah. I think
that became That's nonprofit management, director mm-hmm. status,
yeah.
executive stuff became our careers for both of us.
Yep. And, so I've been doing that since 2004.
So what's that passion you were talking about earlier in terms of the parks and the work that you're doing?
Well, I mean, late 70s, 1980-ish, I think. I'd say 1980s, like the year. I'd been skateboarding, but that was when I was kind of like was rolling around in my driveway, I think, and I'd look down, I'd look at this thing, and I was like, this is it. This is what I am. This is what I do. You know, that was when, as a young teen, I think unlike a lot of kids, I actually found my identity. I found the thing that spoke to me. And, it wasn't like I had this great talent for it, but it was something that I just loved to do.
How do you hold on to that for 30 some odd years then, or 40 years really?
I think at the time, I'd built a ramp and kids would come over and, and we had a skate park for a short period of time up in Northern California, Winchester Skate Park. It was really famous then. And Steve Caballero's home.
San Jose, right?
Yeah. And Cab was a local pro and, there were some really good skaters. And so for me, it was like, there was this awesome thing going on. And then the park closed, And I kind of thought, like a lot of skate parks, it was going to, just be kind of boarded up and you could jump the fence and skate it or whatever.
Right.
But literally the day it closed, they tore it out. And I think my mom drove me by there like a week later. She was gonna drop me off and let me skate.
It was like pipeline down here. Same thing.
Kind of. Yeah. Like my mom drove me to the skate park, let me trespass for a couple hours and then come pick me up. Yeah. She was really great about that. And we drove by and it was just dirt, field. Yeah. And there's a couple of tractors out there. And I wasn't ready for that. That was my home away from home. And
did you cry?
I just sat there with my mouth agape and my mom just kind of looked at me and I was like, I literally felt this hole in my stomach open up.
That's why I asked, because that must be the reaction to something you're so serious and passionate about.
Yeah, as a kid, you're looking for that thing. What's that thing in your life? And for me, it was skateboarding. The first time I went to that skate park, I was like, there's nothing like this. There's nothing like flowing through this park and rolling through the bowls and progressing and learning something and adapting and, So
was it skateboarding before photography, before music, before any of that? It was always skateboarding was just more for you in that.
Yeah. For me, skateboarding has been the thing that's introduced, everything in my life since then to me in one way or another.
What's the difference between you and somebody who is really passionate about it as a kid, has the ramps, goes to the parks, has the friends, it becomes their social network, and then it just falls off for them?
I guess I'm just lucky. A couple of things happened, so the park closed and I would skate, there's some backyard pools and, I learned to go find ramps that were built with stolen wood out in the woods, a couple backyard pools that I could trespass and go skate. And I knew how to, jump through the fence and get away when the guy showed up. You, as a skater back then, this was the early 80s, you learn to bob and weave.
Navigate.
And it was just part of the game. You weren't wanted anywhere. And so, about a year later, I was living with my mom and the topic came up and I'm like, hey, we should move to San Diego, cause Del Mar Skate Ranch was still open. We had visited it the year before.
So that was the impetus for moving to San Diego was Del Mar Skate
Ranch. I guess she was ready for some change in her life. She's like, oh, that's a good idea. And next thing I knew, we were packing up and moving to San Diego. And, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, great. I'm next to a skate park again. And we had literally moved to Cardiff, which was just up the road from Del Mar.
Yeah.
And, that was August of 1982. And, the first day I went down to the park, they had a big pro contest, the Rusty Harris series. And, I recognized a lot of guys. And one of them was Tony Hawk. And I was like, hey, I just moved down here from San Jose. He's like, oh, that's really cool. He's like, where do you live? I go, Cardiff. He goes, oh, I just moved to Cardiff. Because he was, he grew up in San Diego.
Right.
And so we lived in the same town. We were going to the same high school this next fall. And I'm like, oh, cool. So your
connection to him goes that far back.
Yeah. 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 And so that first, I remember that after that contest, he won that contest. I think it might have been his first or second win as a pro. So high school orientation, I'm sitting there and he walks up, he's like, hey, Mick, whatever. You know, I'm like, cool, you know? And, you know, we were the only two skaters in the whole school at the time.
So you just connected over that?
Yeah, I mean, we were the two outcasts. And every day we'd finish school, go to the park. And Grant Britton, the park manager, lived in Cardiff right up the street from me. So he'd, at 11 o'clock at night, park would close, and he'd drive me home. It was pretty awesome for me, you know? And I was just there.
It's a special time that's a lot different than skateboarding today, huh?
Mm-hmm. It was so centralized. I mean, that park was the epicenter of so much.
Right.
And even in the skateboard industry today, you see so many people who were part of that crew.
Exactly. I was just thinking when you brought up Grant Britton, I was thinking it, like, names started rolling through my head. It's like, of course, Grant Britton. And just like all of those people that just had something to do with San Diego skateboarding at the time, that for me as like a 10-year-old, like I'd open Thrasher or Transworld or 10, 12-year-old or whatever. Because, you know, for me, like 1986 was like the big year for me in skateboarding. Mm-hmm. That was like a big year because I think that's when like Bones Brigade 2 came out, or Animal Chin was on the cusp of coming out in 87.
Yeah.
And like that was, you know, for me, that was huge. I mean, like Tommy Guerrero was my hero, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that he was my favorite of the Bones Brigade by far, because the street stuff was just like what I was into. And anyway, so I'd get the magazines, and like all these people just were so centralized, like you're saying, to like Del Mar and San Diego, and just all those names would just keep coming up everywhere in the magazine. Either they shot a photo, or they were in a photo, or they wrote an article or whatever, but it was just that crew was big.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were a handful of skate parks at the time. I mean, Upland and Whittier up in LA area were open for a little bit, but everything else had closed down. Del Mar was open, and then eventually those two closed, so it was really just Del Mar.
Yeah.
And so all the big contests were there. Every summer, a bunch of Europeans would show up and just live in the parking lot or in the trampolines that were adjacent to the skate park. And it was just this mecca, you know? If you just went to the park every day, you would see a bunch of Texans or, you know, whoever.
Right. John Gibson.
Oh, and man. Dan Wilkes would come and stay with me. And, you know, and I would just, like, I'd show up at home with, like, back to our apartment with some Germans or Texans or whoever. And my mom would go, oh, hey, you know, she was used to it.
She's just supportive of it.
I'd bring home all these strays and, you know, and it was, you know, it was just cool. Like, I was just into it, and I meet skaters, and like, they were traveling and they needed a place to sleep and take a shower. I'm like, yeah, come on, you know.
So describe skateboarding in 2016.
You know, it's really pretty amazing. I think, you know, from the early 80s, it was all real specific. It was pretty much vert, and there was some freestyle. And then street skating came along, and it all became just all street skating, you know, through the 90s pretty much. And it was real regimented in a way. And, you know, I worked with the magazine, you know, Grant Britton had left the skate park to go help start Transworld. And then I started shooting, and he helped me become a photographer basically. And, you know, gave me my first jobs. One of my first photography jobs was shooting the construction of the Animal Chin ramp.
No way.
Yeah. So I shot the whole thing.
Where was that? It was in the desert.
It was in Oceanside.
It was in Oceanside?
Almost like where the new Oceanside skate park is. It was like 200 yards from there.
I thought the ramp was in the desert. Well, in the video, it's they
make it.
Even the atmosphere around it or the surrounding.
It was just this open field and next to like a river, and it was literally between two junkyards.
How funny.
And so I shot that and then did more magazine work, and through college I ended up doing, you know, magazine stuff. But, so it was just like, so skateboarding, you know, being in the magazine, you could see all the things evolving, and street skating was the thing through the 90s, and it was all very specific. You had to do certain tricks and look a certain way, and it was lame. It was pretty regimented. But, you know, starting in 2000, you started to see things open up a little bit. And, you know, certainly with all the skate parks opening up, you know, now there were legal places to go skate. So when you're 25, 30, 35, whatever, you don't want to get a ticket or get arrested for skating in a parking lot somewhere, you know? And so you're probably not going to skate much, if at all, unless you have a ramp.
You can be like me and get arrested at a skate park, which happened.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
How'd that work out?
So it's Mother's Day of 2001. Yeah, 2001. Mother's Day 2001. I know, because I was working at a particular record label at the time. It was before I started at 411. I'm at the skate park with my brother, he's 7 years younger than me. And at the time I was, I don't know, 25 maybe. And so my brother was like, I guess he was 17, 18. So he's there with me or whatever. So we're there and we're skating and everything's cool. And, a friend of mine was leaving. A friend of mine had hurt his knee and wasn't skating, and he was leaving. He just came to watch and hang out. And I remember very specifically, he was a huge Lakers fan, and the Lakers were in the playoffs, and it was Mother's Day, and it was like a big deal. So he needed to go home and watch the Laker game with his mom or something. So anyway, so he's leaving. I go up to the fence. It's like one of those long sort of corrugated steel like bar fences that you can like pass things through. It's not like chain link or anything. So go up, give him five through the fence, and he leaves. About 5 minutes later, the cops show up. And so there's cops all different directions coming onto the skate park, and they're like basically hovering around me from all these different angles saying, "What are you doing? Relax, calm down." And I'm like, I'm just sitting here on the wall. Like, I'm not doing anything. Like, I've just been skating. There's three people at this park, and two of them are me and my brother. So anyways, cops come up, they start giving me tons and tons of attitude. Right. Uh-huh. And they go, "Come here, sit on the curb of the board." And I'm like, okay. I'm like, I'm an adult. Like, you don't, like, what is going on here? Like, this was really, like, I'm seriously, like, thrown just completely for a loop over what's going on. So anyway, so they say, "Sit on the curb." I go, "All right." And so they start all barking at me. All three cops are now, like, converged on me, are in my face, and they're all yelling at me. And I'm going, "Guys, I was just skating." They're like, "What have you been doing here? What have you been doing?" And I'm like, "I've been skateboarding. I don't know how many effing times I have to tell you." "Mm-hmm. "Oh, you're going to cuss at me?" And then one of them reaches down and grabs my board. So do you remember those old Reel ads? "Never let them take your board. Never let them take your skateboard." So I was actually just like, it was the first thing. I didn't think of it at the time, but after all this, it was like one of the first things I thought. I was like, God, it was so dumb to do that. Because, and it was actually a Max shaft that Max had given me when my leg was broken.
Wow.
Facilitated by Jim Thibode, who knew somebody who I knew in the Bay Area. Yeah. And it was just, anyways, it was just random, but it was really special to me because Max was one of my favorite skaters of all time. And it was cool that I was finally riding this board that he gave me because my leg had healed and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, so cop yells, "I'll take your board," and grabs the front truck. I instinctively go, "Fuck that." And I grab the back truck, and then the other two cops jump on me like right away. And then they called it resisting arrest. And what had happened is the third person at the skate park was like a 7 or 8 year old boy. His mom was there watching him. His mom said that I was passing drugs through the fence when I gave my friend five. So I went to jail for that and spent 6 hours or something like that in jail on Mother's Day. Had my mom come bail me out.
Wait, they didn't find any drugs?
No, of course not. I was not a drug user at the time. Still not, nothing, not a dealer, obviously. So what they got me for was resisting arrest because they didn't like my attitude and stuff. So I had to go before a judge. I got signatures of 100 kids that I skated that park with just basically every single day. I had them and their parents sign it that I was not a problem at the skate park, that I had no issues. Because I'm like, I don't want this on my record. So judge looks at it. He goes, "Oh, this is great. I'm glad all these people, you know, respect you. But you shouldn't have resisted arrest. You got 40 hours community service and a misdemeanor." And I was like,
nice.
Fuck. Yeah, really.
Do you want to volunteer for a skate park project? We love putting community service people to work.
Yeah, no, I had cleaned bathrooms. It was great.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really cool. Anyways, so that was my experience getting
arrested. Which police department was that?
La Habra Skate Park, which is now a dump. I went there not too long ago, and they don't take care of it. It's just all trash and graffiti and just, yeah.
I just wanted to point out which department that was.
Yeah, absolutely. I got no problem with that.
Yeah, that's a good story. In fact, I think that's probably what got you the job at 411.
Yeah,
oh, you've been arrested for skateboarding?
Or? Yeah, I know, right? Great. It certainly wasn't my skill on a skateboard.
But. Well... Mine neither, but around when all the parks started opening, when I started working with the foundation, you know, certainly, you know, suddenly there were places you could go that were legal. And I mean, instinctively, I just began mostly skating at skate parks, and a lot of them had transition and bowls, and, you know, so older guys who had kind of quit suddenly had a place they can go. A lot of them had kids who wanted to skate, and now there was a place where they could take their kid and skate with them. And so these days, you know, there's everything in skateboarding. I mean, you go to a shop and there are boards with all different shapes. There are wheels of every size and durometer. There's trucks that are narrow and wide and, you know, longboard turning trucks and, you know, tight, low profile street trucks. And
longboarding became a real, like, I live near a college. Mm-hmm. Longboarding became like a real thing.
Yeah. And that's skateboarding. I mean, it's commuting. Yeah. You know, those people pretty much just use it to get around to class, to get back to the dorm room. Better than driving, you know,
sure,
easier than a bike. You don't have to lock it up. You can carry it around. So it's really diversified. And, I mean, it's really healthy today in the sense that, you know, there's estimated about 25% of skateboarders are women.
That's awesome.
Which, you know, would include.
Wow. Really? It's that high? That's really cool.
I mean, in terms of like park skating and like kind of core street skating and that kind of thing, it's a lot less, but. There's a whole movement. It's really growing.
That's amazing.
That's really encouraging. And
I think women's surfing was the first action sport, and then snowboarding too.
Pretty big,
snowboarding's big too.
Skateboarding's been slow, and I think it's just there's a certain intimidation to getting on a board, and you know what it culturally. Well, there's falling.
The cultural thing is like the not machismo thing, but like there is like kind of sometimes. if you go to a skate park and you see a bunch of guys like all standing around and they're all skating and stuff, I mean if you were anybody it would look intimidating, you know.
Sure.
It's
gritty and it's not ladylike or whatever. But you know, I think the newer generation of
it's awesome.
Women are like they're breaking out of all kinds of stereotypes.
I would love it if my daughter skated. I would love it.
Yeah. And so that's happening. And so you go to a skate park today and you'll see, you know, dads and kids, moms, whole families, girls, you know, down in San Diego, any skate park I go to, there's always a crew of girls skating usually together. And they're so good. And it's fun to watch and fun to skate with them. And just, you know, whoever, you know.
One thing I've noticed where skating's changed. Mm-hmm. So I don't skate anymore. So I haven't stepped on a board since 2006, I think. So about 10 years. I mean, other than just pushing around the neighborhood with my kids, which I'll do a little, like I have a board set up over there and like, I'll, you know, it's a nice anti-hero and I'll go and just like push around, but I won't do a single trick. I maybe landed one ollie on it in like 10 years. But one thing I've noticed is that skateboarding used to have, well, and this is the part that kind of, sometimes I kind of go back and forth on, like, skateboarding is very accepted now and there's this commercialism and all that. And so one of the issues with that for me is that it, you know, has it lost kind of that punk rock edginess to it, sort of that, you know, outlaw sort of mentality, which you and I were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. Like we kind of think riding bikes at our age is kind of comparable to that.
Yeah. People yell at you just as much.
Right. Exactly. But the thing I like that has kind of been brought along with that is that, you know, skateboarding used to, I don't want to call it racist, but it had some tendencies to like use language kind of loosely in some in some respects, you know, or people's attitudes about things, you know, or sexism was a huge one. Homophobia was another one. And like a lot of that seems to kind of have, you know, kind of gone away, which I think is really positive.
Yeah. A lot of it was kind of tongue in cheek. Like skateboarding, it really loved to poke at stereotypes and kind of push limits on things. And so there were companies that had like an African-American skater as one of their pros. And then they would put out a board of that skater,
and that's exactly what I was thinking.
With a depiction of that skater holding, you know, watermelon
or 40
something,
or
you know, or just whatever the stereotype, and it was like
gold teeth or something.
I mean, it wasn't racist.
Like that,
it was deliberately racist because they were making a point that it's just racism is stupid.
Yeah,
and, you know, and there was a lot of sexist stuff that was sort of in that same vein, sort of tongue in cheek, but at the same time, it's like a bunch of dudes doing it, so it kind of came across as.
Right.
It's actually a sexist, you know.
Right.
But you know, it was just sort of anything goes at that time.
Yeah.
And these days, the thing about it today is skateboarding is so diverse. There's so many different opportunities. There's so many different ways to ride, and you know, everybody can find a place to go and a way to do it. Everything that used to exist still does. You could still be a, you know, core street skater and go find spots and get rested or whatever you want to do. Nothing more than get rested, but, you know, do that. You can go find backyard pools. You can, you know, go skate parks. You can go find ramps. You can go pay to skate at a, you know, like a private skate park.
Park or something.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but most of the new skate parks, there's about 3,000 of them in there around the country. And they're, you know, mostly free public parks, just like your local basketball court, tennis court kind of thing. And
recreational activities.
Yeah, it's acknowledged as, you know, there's 5.4 million skaters.
And you think that overall that's a positive development?
I think so. You know, a lot of people are miffed because it's not a special club anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, ever since I was a kid and I remember seeing, you know, in 1980, 81, you know, Steve Caballero just won the, you know, the Kona Nationals. And he got a whopping $1,000.
Right.
The same day, and I finished reading that magazine, Jack Nicklaus was on TV winning some PGA contest.
1 million or something.
He got like 100 grand or something like that. And I was just like, what? You know, like why? Like they're swinging a stick around. These guys are like
killing themselves for skating.
They're ripping, you know, and skating in Florida in the middle of summer. Like
slamming, you know, to make some trick. Yeah.
You know, it's so much harder. And so there was just that lack of respect for skateboarding, which for me, because it was so core to my being at the time and my identity, you know, I always felt like that was just a wrong.
As bad as I have always been at it, one of the things I've always just appreciated about that, and I think like, maybe this speaks to certain kinds of people, those of us who are like softer, sensitive or something, but there's like a hashtag that goes on Instagram a lot, the thank you skateboarding hashtag.
Yeah.
Every time I see it, I think to myself, like whoever posted that or whatever it is, there's somebody connecting to this that makes them, it's skateboarding makes them feel whole. It's like, it's their thing that they do that kind of, that pulls them together as a person, like it completes them as a person.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything like, that's awesome. Like that, like my favorite thing about stuff like skateboarding or stuff like cycling or whatever is when you have that feeling of like centralness. I don't know, like the, I don't know what the word is, but like, this is who I am. This is my, right. like kind of, this is what represents me. And when I go do it, I feel better than I feel doing anything else, you right. know? And I mean, that's cool. And it's especially cool with something like skating, which can be so hard and can be painful mm-hmm. and can, it takes years of dedication. But when people are doing that and they feel that invested in it, it's yeah. really special. And there's not a lot of activities, I think, that people get that sense from.
Yeah. I mean, it's taken me 35 years to get mediocre at skateboarding,
right.
you know, like, and I wouldn't say satisfied, but I accept that and
right.
I enjoy it. And I just I love it for what it is.
But you had a really good comment the other day. We were talking about cyclocross, about how hard it is when you and I were texting about it. Whenever Eddie Merckx finished a race, mm-hmm. right? We were talking about cross specifically, but that's because we both raced cross. But Merckx was, you know, obviously a racer of mm-hmm. Grand Tours and Classics and all of those things and track and everything else.
Right. And by the way, people, we're talking about a discipline of cycling that is a racing discipline with road bikes in the dirt.
Steeplechase on a bicycle.
There you go.
Yeah. But you said Merckx had the best, you know, natural talent of anyone mm-hmm. we've ever seen and everything else. And we all acknowledge he's without question. I mean, by and large, 99.9% of people are going to say he's the greatest cyclist to ever mm-hmm. live, but he suffers just like we suffer. It's the exact mm-hmm. same thing. So even in skateboarding,
yeah.
you know, slam is a slam. It hurts the same for you as it hurts for Tony Hawk or anybody mm-hmm. else. You know, the level that showing up and skating hard for 2 hours is the same for both of you.
Right.
It's, you know, what your takeaway from that is, like the thank you skateboarding thing, you know?
Yeah. I think there's, you know, we do these things because there's some element of personal growth
right.
in pursuing it and trying to advance and trying to learn what your limits are and,
yeah.
and push those limits a little bit. And, you know, so whatever your limits are, I mean, you're born with a certain ability,
right.
whether it's balance or endurance or whatever. And some of us are more gifted. And so you're supposed to win the Tour de France, you know, five yeah. times or whatever. You're supposed to win 500 contests in your career, you know, whatever the sport and case may be. But I think the point is we can all get the same thing out of it if we apply ourselves and really put ourselves into it. And again, it's whatever the yeah. pursuit is, whether it's sport or
totally.
Art or,
you it's know. Those romantic notions about things that I really mm-hmm. appreciate, you know? And I yeah. think like with skateboarding, I just appreciate it because I mean, I know how hard it is and I know how, you know, dedicated people yeah. get to it. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. I mean, nobody's tried harder than I have in my life to
right.
be a great skateboarder. And I just, it's just certain things aren't in me. Certain things are. And
all you need is a front side grind anytime.
Yeah. For the most part, you know, yeah. like if I can do some carb lines through a bowl, like yeah. there's nothing more exhilarating to me
exactly.
Than that. And I'm sure if I could do a 6 foot air, I would feel even, you know, more exhilarated,
you'd have the same exhilaration just doing something else. You know what I mean?
Right.
You'd still feel great about the fact that you're doing it. I mean,
yeah.
copying a couple ollies here and there. I mean, yeah, like right now, if I could get on that board and go mm-hmm. ollie up a curb successfully,
yeah,
I would feel like, wow, like, holy crap, mm-hmm. like that's amazing. My day would be made. I'd be telling my wife about it.
Yeah.
I'd be like, fuck, I hadn't skated in 10 years and I went out and ollied up a curb, you know?
But you know, if you dedicate 2 hours, you could relearn how to do that.
Yeah, I know.
So someday you may.
Yeah.
But that's a beautiful thing. Like now you can go do that. You can do that on your street. You can go find a skate park
yeah.
in anywhere, most any town around, yeah. certainly around Orange County in LA. You know, there's a lot of options for skaters. And that's the great thing because now everybody can benefit from this thing that I know
yeah.
for me has been, you know, life changing and just the core of who I am and who I've become. And, you know, it's been part of the trajectory of my whole life since
yeah.
I was 11.
And you're 47 now.
Yeah.
So skateboarding is obviously not a midlife crisis thing for you.
No, skateboarding is my whole life crisis.
So what was your midlife crisis?
So cycling is my midlife crisis.
Is it?
Yeah. So, you know, I've my parents are from Yugoslavia, Eastern Europe and, Central Europe, I think technically. Area of former Yugoslavia now known as Montenegro. And, so I grew up with soccer and my brothers and I all played soccer through our lives. And so that's always been with me. And then skateboarding, something I chose later in my life, that my other family members, oldest brother skated a little bit and I was probably first introduced to it from him in the mid 70s. But it was later that I kind of picked it up on my own and went with it. But, you know, so through all the years of playing soccer and particularly in Southern California, you know, it's just, you're stomping around on really, really hard packed ground. And, you know, by the time you hit 40,
yeah.
your knees are pretty
yep.
beat.
Basketball for me.
Yeah.
yeah.
And, you know, and I was playing intramural leagues and different things like that. But, you know, so I was looking for a way to, you know, rehab my knees, and cycling really seemed to be it. So yeah. It started as a rehab thing, and you just kind of get sucked in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
what do you think of it now? Now that you're, you know, now you're doing it for more than that purpose.
It's fascinating. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of interesting parallels, ironically with skateboarding and just its history and, certain things about the culture. There is a bit of a renegade, element to cycling. You know, you're out on the road and you're not well appreciated by motorists. But you have the right to be there, you know? And so
yeah,
you kind of
traffic like they are,
you kind of have to, I mean, you have to be careful, but you have to kind of impose yourself a little bit. And that's just second nature to a skateboarder, you know?
Yeah.
And I always thought of, you know, so when I got on my bike on a Saturday, early on Saturday, just go out for a few hours, that I was a kind of entering this different world. And then as I started, eventually I started racing bikes, and next thing you know, I'm running into other skateboarders,
right,
who are racing bikes. And it was just really strange. But there's this interesting convergence of
all ages too, not just necessarily people in midlife crisis situation, yeah, but younger skaters too. Like I see them on Instagram, pros that are in their maybe early 30s or late 20s that have taken up cycling too.
Yeah. So anyways, it took me a few years to realize, like, you know, like why, cause it was something that was new to me, the way that skateboarding was when I was 11. Yeah. And it kind of gave me this sort of youthful perspective on something.
Were you weird about it the first time you put Lycra on?
Oh yeah. I used to wear shorts over the Lycra cause you know, for like 2 years. I mean,
I love
you know,
it.
And then I realized that, you know, I got to just suck it up and realize that I do this and just be in it and just not make excuses. And, cause I always thought, like, I'm a skater, I'm just riding a bike. And then at some point I'm like, oh, I'm also a cyclist. Right. And that's the beautiful thing about skateboarding is it's, if you get involved in skateboarding, it's going to introduce you to 1,000 other things.
Sure.
I mean, photography, art, music, we're all things that I came to through skateboarding. And, you know, I played drums when I was younger and was in bands and, you know, explored all kinds of music and, you know, started photography. And of course, all my early assignments in high school were all shot at the skate park, you know?
Yeah.
And that evolved into something. So these are all things that came through skateboarding, you know?
You said something interesting in there about kind of figuring out you had a dual identity, right? So you're a skateboarder and a cyclist. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's something that comes from, or was it for you at least, something that came with middle age, was acceptance of those kinds of things? I mean, and I'm talking about like the bigger picture than just skateboarding and cycling, but just kind of when you hit a certain time in your life where you realize that, you know, I don't need to be pigeonholed, or it's time to come to grips with what I actually maybe am or whatever, you know, that
kind
of stuff.
I mean, maybe originally I thought of them as just really not contradictory, but just diametrically opposed worlds.
Huh.
But when I realized that whatever I do, it's me.
Yeah.
And skateboarding is my core and my hub, and off of that I've done these other things, you know.
Right.
It's led me to these other things, and it led me to cycling, really, because I was literally in 2011 I was in Austin, Texas for a nonprofit conference. I was with the foundation that the Lance Armstrong Foundation was hosting, and there was a big cycling event around that conference, and I remember I was at the skate park in Austin, House Skate Park, and skating back to the hotel, I rolled by Lance's bike shop, Mello Johnny's.
Yeah.
And I walked in, and I'd been thinking about, you know, bike cycling as, you know, my knee thing, particularly after the sessions of the park. I was like, oh, my knees are pretty fucked up. And rolled into the shop, and all these guys were standing around. I'm like, oh, those guys look funny in those shorts. You know, but I was whatever.
The same way a cyclist feels when they walk into a skateboard shop.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. And I just remember standing in that shop and thinking, that's really nice in here. And I looked at these bikes, and they were real basic commuter bikes. I'm like, oh, something like that would, you know, I could tour around the neighborhood. I could just, you know, just push the pedals and get my knees going and not have to stomp on the ground and you know, ruin them more. And I saw that, you know, this bike, basic bike, was like $800. Like, oh my God, you know, I can build something for way less than that. And of course, you know, $1,000 later,
those
initial
price sticker shock thing for buying a bike, it's like gateway drug stuff. And at first you're like, oh my God, like that seems like so much money.
Right.
And then you realize, oh, well, I would buy a set of wheels for $1,000 without much hesitation if I could, you know? So, yeah.
But through the process of hand assembling a 1982 Peugeot PF60 steel Brabant bike, you know, with period correct, you know, Mavic wheels and strong light cranks and you know, all these components that made it original and great. You know, I remembered, because I used to work on my BMX bikes back in the days before I was skating, and it was about that same era, you know, roughly. And and so I could do that stuff on my own, and there was a certain satisfaction in building this thing and then riding it and enjoying it. And just kind of started with that. But I just think that, as a skateboarder, that's your identity and that's your core. Mm-hmm. And then off of that, you're several other things. Yeah. You know, I mean, I met my wife through skateboarding, you know, from working at Tomietto when I was doing a website in the mid 90s and, for skateboard.com and she came around and stuff like that. So, and it was some years later that we connected, but, you know, so, I mean, literally skateboarding has given me so much in my life and, yeah. and, you know, I mean, the hashtag thank you skateboarding really applies to everything certainly I've done and potentially accomplished.
Yeah.
But, I owe it a lot. And I, every day I wake up and I have this dream job of going to work and working with great staff and helping communities to try and get skate parks built. And we help them fund them and we help them through the whole process. And when we went 2 or 3 years later, they get to that grand opening, like today, Emeryville, California, near Oakland, opened their park. And, Jim Thebo, our board member, was up there and he just texted me some video from it. And I was just like,
so cool. And with a young, I saw it because we were at lunch, a young mayor wearing Vans. Yeah. I think that's the generational
difference.
Their
mayor was, there was a video he sent me of the mayor of Emeryville, who I think maybe might be 35, 40-ish. And she was giving her welcoming speech and thanking the Tony Hawk Foundation, and which was great. And she was wearing Vans high tops.
So cool.
And that's the difference between now and like, you know, 2002 when we started. It was back then we had to really convince people. You know, this skateboarding is a great thing for kids, and this is who these kids are. Like, we had the kids involved in the project, so they can go to city council, they could, you know, give speeches, and they can talk about their passion for skateboarding and let these people realize that this is something they were willing to pursue and to work with them to get these parks built. And they weren't just looking for a handout. And, you know, and the tactic has gone from convincing people that skateboarding is worthwhile and skate parks are worthwhile to now you have politicians who are skateboarders or have kids who skate.
Right.
And they're just like, it's automatic. Like, yeah, we know we need it. How do we do it? So you're past that whole hurdle of like, why do we do it? Now it's like, just how do we do it?
Yeah. So now the midlife crisis for all of us becomes, how do we get a park built for our kids?
Yeah.
No, that's cool. I mean, I think like what I really respect about you, and one of the things I've always respected about you, is that it's really hard, and this is what I was talking about earlier. It's really hard to find people who didn't deviate away from that path, right? So they really loved. I mean, because look at, man, you know, I could tell you like line by line. Well, maybe not trick by trick, somewhat line by line, somewhat like the Sub-Zero video with Ricky Oyola, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because that was such a big part of my teenage years, mm-hmm. right? It was really important to me, but that didn't keep me interested in skateboarding once I became an adult, right? Like, I mean. Like I said, 2006 rolled around. I went to Europe. I skated with some friends. I came back and I was like, man, I'm pretty much done. And like, I just like right. what I respect about you is that that's never really, I mean, even for cycling, I cycled, I rode as a kid. My dad raced. It was a huge part of my life. I have a poster my dad got right above me from Nelson Vales. I mean, that's signed. I mean, I have original VHS tapes of Paris-Roubaix in 1986 that I recorded mm-hmm. not my parents that
right.
I recorded.
Right.
But even that, like, I fell off for a long time and came back to it. But you, someone like you, has just stuck with this thing that was so important to you mm-hmm. the entire time. And I mean, not everyone can do that.
Yeah.
I think that's really admirable.
Well,
admirable is a weird word to use.
Yeah. Well, for me, skateboarding's always given back to me. Like, I always, whenever I skate, I feel it's a struggle. You know, I got there and I got to put a lot into it and I get what I can get out of it physically. But I always feel refreshed. I always feel like that was a great, you know, sort of little workout. And then I had this mental reset.
Yeah, that's cycling for me.
Yeah. And I get some of that with the bike, and the bike is more endurance. I don't have to be super skillful necessarily. I can just go out and ride. And that's a nice thing about it. Skateboarding is more skill-based. It's a whole different thing. And they both give me totally different experiences. And so they work together in that sense. And for me, you know, like it's, you know, I'll call it my midlife crisis, but cycling is just this kind of new thing that,
I think it's avoiding the stereotypical midlife crisis mm-hmm. is investing yourself into these things.
Well, I think it's a positive one.
Right, exactly. It's productive and it's positive and it's a good thing.
I didn't buy that, you know, that red Corvette.
I was thinking of Porsche. Yeah.
Yeah. I bought a bright orange Santa Cruz bicycle.
I bought a Pagaretti. So.
Yeah, right. So, but it took me a while to realize, oh yeah, that's maybe part of what, you know, the attraction is. So, it's just life. And I think, though, that even if you're not skating, you know, like you're talking about watching those videos, Oyola and those guys.
Yeah, I can still watch those now, even though I don't skate, and love it.
But you learned a lot at that time that's informed who you are now. And you probably don't even realize it, but you're in your job day to day making executive decisions. and you're relying on a thought process that you probably developed as a skateboarder.
Yeah.
You know, problem solving skills, adaptation abilities.
I think about the people like I hire, right? Mm-hmm. And I think about the people that I know and want to spend time with. Like, yeah. I want them to have had real life experiences. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, you know, some things I can point to that were definitely growth points, right? Mm-hmm. Is spending all night skating a fucking parking block with right. people and, yeah. you know, drinking beer when yeah. you're 17 and you're not supposed to be doing it.
Right.
I mean, those are moments that are foundational for being who you are, for better or worse, right? Right. But I mean, it's real life experience that, you know, somebody who hasn't lived, I mean, or done some things right. they were that invested in or that interested right. in or whatever, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's different, I think, for people.
Right.
You know, I think skateboarding is one of those things. Again, it's one of those activities that when you do it and you're that invested in it, it defines who you are to some degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it totally informs your worldview. And yeah. I mean, even though you're not skateboarding, you're still a skateboarder.
Yeah.
Even when you're on your bike.
Yeah.
Okay. As far removed, you're wearing Lycra and you're zooming through
yes,
town.
Yes. When I see ledges, I think about tricks on them.
Yeah. You yeah. ride through yeah. terrain and you're yeah. seeing banks and you're seeing ledges and you're
when
seeing
we went
stuff
to your,
that's
when we went to your, it was so funny you say that. When we went to your godbrother's house today, yep. dropped by randomly,
yep.
his driveway was so banked, I was yep. thinking, oh man, a big kickflip to fake you would look really cool right here. I mean, that's like the first thing I thought when I saw it. And yeah. I'm like, I don't know if that's just because I'm riding with Mickey today or if I would always think that. But yeah, I mean, look, curbs especially, you see curbs and I always think, God, a slappy, they're right. really awesome. You know,
skateboarding has taught you things that you yeah. still use. And my friend Gavin O'Brien came up with this theory years back. He called it skater's advantage.
And Corey O'Brien's brother, right?
Yeah.
yeah.
He was Santa Cruz team manager for a while.
Yeah, and, right.
Sonic skateboards. But Gavin's theory was you take two people, you know, all things being equal, if one of them's a skateboarder, you put them in a new situation, the skateboarder is going to adapt and figure it out and succeed way more often than
that's
non-skateboarder.
So smart.
And you see it time and time again from, you know, guys in skateboarding who've gone on to do incredible things
yeah.
Without some, you know, really formal training in it, you know, whether it's Jason Lee and his acting and Spike Jones is directing a couple of things that people
you
mentioned.
And you and running a nonprofit.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean...
For sure,
it's probably something that in the back of my mind I thought about when I took the job. I was like, oh, that's a kind of a different, just a bit of a departure for what I've done, which sure. is media work. But it makes sense to me. Like, and I kind of probably thought about that and
right.
you know, realized that, you know, I've been telling as a kid when I realized the inequity in what skateboarders were receiving in terms of accolades and compensation for their skills and their yeah. success compared to other sports that are to me are super boring. I really wanted to see things grow. I wanted to see these guys rewarded. I wanted to see skateboarding respected. And so I think I, you know, subconsciously got on a path to end up working at a magazine to promote skateboarding, help it grow. And then the videos again, promote skateboarding, tell the stories, get people excited about it, help it grow. And with the foundation, you know, we've literally been, you know, with the magazines and the videos, you're preaching to the choir, right?
Right, right.
You know, these are you're talking about skateboarding to skateboarders, which is great. It's inspiring to them, hopefully, and it gets them out skating more. But you know, with the foundation, we're talking to not just non-skateboarders, but people who, you know, are oftentimes adverse to skateboarding,
right.
the NIMBYs. You know, not in my backyard. Like, it's, you know, a lot of advocates have to deal with these people, and we go into meetings sometimes when we can. And you deal with these people who are like, I don't want that here, these criminals, and, you know.
I mean, this is not dissimilar from the work I've done with the homeless in my
yeah.
second career, you know,
yeah.
the last 10, almost
people
10
have,
years.
They have a stereotype about
yeah,
who those people are. And it's like, there's 1 in 6 kids are skaters. That's either your kid or your kid's friends. Like,
yep.
That's who are we talking about? It's not a niche group.
It's amazing you say that, because so now that I work in mm-hmm. more domestic violence-oriented type of stuff for nonprofits, 1 in 4 women will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And so I have to walk into a room of 400 people
right.
and say, okay, 52% of you are women, if they use the standard sort mm-hmm. of, you know, the percentage in America, right?
Right.
That means roughly 200 of you are women, and that means 50 of you are going to experience domestic violence over the course of your lifetime, and maybe you've never thought of it before. So
right.
it's the same thing. It's I mean, it's obviously it's a different level of probably seriousness,
yeah.
but it's the 1 in 6. Like, look, this is you and your community and what
yeah.
goes on, and you
so,
making that argument's important. You
yeah.
know?
So part of my decision to work with the foundation was, I just get to tell more stories about skateboarding,
yeah.
but now I get to tell to people who don't skate, and I get to try and share the excitement that I've experienced and the things that I've learned being involved with it at the level that I was through the media. you know, and explain to them really kind of what it is, and hopefully, you know, debunk a lot of the stereotypes that, that they had. And that was a bit more challenging, but it, to me, it was like a really welcoming challenge.
Is that job of converting people, or like, is that something you, you, is that kind of where the rush comes from sometimes with you when you can like change someone's perspective on it?
And it is, because people will say the stupidest things, and
right,
you know, you're so eager to just correct them, and not to embarrass them or to belittle them, but you really like this, the success is in turning them around.
Right.
Is in, you know, convincing them, you know what, this is what, this is the reality. Let's do this. Let's build this. And then when it's done, you go back and you go, see, and you look at them and they go, oh, that's what you're talking about.
Right.
And that's the most rewarding thing. It's not about like battling somebody and conquering them and outvoting them and putting them in their place. It's about,
well, you catch more flies with honey, right? I mean, it's the whole idea that, you know, you have to massage people into doing things sometimes that, well, you want them to do, or let them come to the conclusion on their own. That's the biggest lesson I've learned as I've gotten older.
Right.
It's better to lead people, give them a path to figure it out. And then when they get there, they feel like they own the decision. Right. And that's much more powerful.
Well, as a young skateboarder, I remember, you know, you turn and you run. So you see somebody, you know, you're trespassing, you're doing something wrong, turn and run. And you were so passionate about it that you were willing to break the law to do it, because there was nowhere else legally to do it. All the parks had closed, literally. And so, you know, I think it's the high road for skateboarders to step up and work with their local leadership, you know, and that's why we're here. We're here to, the Petroniak Foundation is here to help them do that and say, you know what, we want to stop running. Yeah. We want to work with you, and we want to solve this for the betterment of everybody.
Right.
This isn't just a special interest. I mean, we want to build something that's going to be in the community that we can enjoy, obviously, but the BMXers and the kids on scooters can come and use it. And other people can come and watch and enjoy the athleticism and the art, artistic, you know, expressions that these kids are exhibiting, and they skate in these parks. I mean, the lines and the flow and the routine,
Skateboarding.
It's really wonderful. It, I mean, it's like most people's experience is like a kid jumping off of stairs and right in front of them, or zooming past them on the sidewalk. And, you know, it's a negative connotation, but they go to the park and suddenly they see it in an arena where it's sort of framed. And it's like, you know, the kids can skate in a space where there's trick to trick to trick, and they can see this.
Well, there's something to be said for this. There's something to be said for just making friends and having a social bond with other people, something that you connect over, you know? I mean, that's important stuff in a community. And
yeah.
I mean, skateboarding, I mean, of all things, I mean, that will pull kids of like-minded sensibilities who otherwise might feel isolated together. And I mean, look, let's face it, like in 2016, skateboarding is not a unique thing anymore necessarily among kids. I mean, some kids do it, some kids don't. Mm-hmm. But you're more likely to find somebody who does it these days than you were 15, 20 years ago, for sure.
Right.
But the point is that, you know, if those are lifelong bonds that are healthy that your kids develop because of skateboarding, well, that's even more of a reason to promote and try to encourage them to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And
to
not take it away from them when they can't do it, you know, or try to create a situation where it's harder for them to do it.
And if you think street skating or pool skating is now not special because it's not hardcore and it's not unique and cool, you know, then take up flatland freestyle, you know, like do something really obscure.
Go be Parawellander.
Whatever, you know, like do something that no one else is doing with it. I mean, you know.
Take it to some other level.
Just whatever.
Hey, so you have another interest, which actually the reason that I think a lot of people knew you originally is because of your photography. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. That was just a natural extension of skateboarding. Like when I realized I wasn't going to be in the contests, I kind of wanted to be at the contests, and the best seats were the guy around the pool.
The guy with the media badge.
Yeah, the guy with the camera standing right next to the bowl.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just a natural, for me, a natural thing to want to do.
What's your archive at home like of photos?
Five filing cabinets.
Of printed photos?
Of negatives.
A lot of negatives?
Just all negatives.
So what are you shooting on now these days?
I have a Canon Mark Canon 5D Mark II.
That's digital.
Digital, yeah. And then I have some film cameras, but you know, it's really not practical to shoot film so much. So I use the film cameras for just special projects that, you know, are that I want to look a certain way.
So do you miss that analog look and feel of photos?
Yeah, I do in a way. I mean, these days everybody's a photographer. It's just like, you know.
Well, you have Instagram on your phone, right? So
yeah, I'm as guilty as anyone. I shoot almost all my photos on my phone, and then, you know, for special things I'll pick up the camera, and then for extra special things I'll pick up the film camera, and usually that's some kind of a, you know, I have this Russian plastic camera that actually has nice lenses on it, but you know, it has a certain look and feel that's unique, and so I'll use that for certain things, But it's great. You can in photography, there's all kinds of options now. Digital, you can shoot digital and then do whatever you want with it. And, you know, people argue that it looks this or looks that. But really, I mean, at the resolution you've got, you can do so much with it that it's, you know, everything's going to be scanned and printed at some point. So do you think some of the
much like people make the argument around skateboarding being accepted now and, you know, okay. Do you feel like a lot of the sort of the magic behind photography has been lost because of this transition into, you know, technology and ease of use and everyone's, my kids have Instagram accounts, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, these days everything's online and everything's video. So no one really looks at a printed magazine and static images anymore. That's a special thing. In fact, it used to be that, you know, in the '90s, the magazine, each magazine title had a corresponding website that had like additional material and
just extra bonus stuff.
It was just sort of like an extra thing. And, and nowadays it's the websites that might have a printed, you know, compendium that's the alternative. You know, that's just things have shifted, but what it means is that, you know, nothing's permanent anymore. Everything's online and it's, you know, like you can change it after it's already published, you know, print. Once it was printed, that's it. A lot more thought and care, I think, went into preparing the material.
Yeah.
And these days, you know, most of the visual stuff is video, and it's all about rushing to get it out. And it's not about, you know, with magazines, you had a 30-day lead time, you know, on a monthly.
So you could take your time to sort of get it.
Kind of, yeah. And you would work on stories for a few months and plan it for, you know, an issue that was way up the road. So things were curated a lot more. And these days it's just, you know, shoot it and edit it as fast as you can.
Content.
Yeah, it's quantity, not quality. And so...
Does that bother you?
It kind of does. It makes me less interested in it.
Is that because you're... Now, I'm not asking this to be snarky, but do you think that's because you're older?
Part of it's that... I think really thoughtful, like film productions. I mean, things are obviously shot in video, but where there's a story arc versus just here's a bunch of footage of, you know, the newest guy. And you know, I want to learn something.
So you just released a book, right? What's that called?
So a new publisher in Oakland, Move Ellore, MoveElore, and they have a website at MoveElore.com. They approached me last year to do a book, and it was an interesting idea.
Had you never done one before?
Mm-hmm, no.
So as recognized as you are in photography, especially skateboarding photography, obviously, you had never been asked to do a book before or had just never done one?
Yeah, just never.
Really?
Neither. Wow. So it was interesting. I was like, you know, I don't know. But there were two things that they asked for. One is that it not be skateboarding, and two, that it be all black and white film images.
Did you have any problems with either one of those requests?
Well, I think the obvious thing for me to do would have been a skateboarding book.
Right.
But I loved the idea that those particular constraints forced me to really think it through.
It's similar to the idea of digital versus analog, where you had to think through what you were doing.
Yeah, it put these interesting.
I mean, it
constraints
is. It's a book.
It.
It's a paper book. It's sitting right here, and it's print photos. You know.
Yeah. And so I had to think about it, and like, do I have a body of work?
Yeah.
Within those constraints, that was worth presenting. And Rich Jacobs, one of the publishers who I've known a long time, you know, he mentioned a couple of photos that had been published of mine from skateboarding articles, from travel articles I'd done, and. You know, that these were like small inset images that were just sort of landscapes or sort of, you know, environmental images to show kind of where we were, you know, in that particular article. And I'd shot lots of that stuff, you know, over the years, not just on those skateboarding trips, but just in my travels. And it was all really just for my own enjoyment. And I thought about that. I go, like taking those images that, you know, I shot with a lot of deliberate, you know, intent.
There's a subsect of us out there that have always liked that stuff more than the regular sort of skateboarding thing. So like at 4-on-1, my favorite videos were Around the World. I loved Around the World.
Yeah.
Around the World was so cool because it was like Kenny Reed and those guys
skateboarding
in India, and you knew kids there had never seen a skateboard before.
And to see those reactions. That was always really cool. Yeah. So we did the book and I spent a couple months putting together the images and it was all black and white film images that I shot between 1983 and 2001. As it turned out, there was a bit of a theme that ran through the final selection that was sort of an East-West, kind of a Cold War theme. And so I kind of went with that.
Yeah. It's apropos for you, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as I looked at the images, I realized that when I shot them, I had, this was the context in which I emerged or kind of grew as a photographer, is this childhood of, A, having parents from Eastern Europe, and B, living there for a couple of years as a child, and C, going to college there for a little bit.
And going into a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, touring a Chernobyl lookalike plant. That became kind of the theme of the book, and it all just kind of organically over the course of, like, we put the whole thing together in like 2 months.
Yeah. It's a cool book, man.
Thank you. It's called really cool. The Atomic Bomb and Other Pleasant Dreams.
Yeah.
And again, it's from Moovalore, moovalore.com. And it didn't turn out great. They did a great job with it, putting it together. And
it's nice because I think I have it, and so you sent me a copy, so I really appreciate it. And it feels like you. It feels like something that came from you, which, having known you, and I mean, obviously we lost touch for a lot of years, but just kind of having known you as a person before and now knowing you again, it feels like something you would produce. And I mean that like in the best way possible, because with like your depth as a person and all the things that you've done and been a part of, it's like a really good example. And then sort of the other thing too is like sort of your continuum in skateboarding history is really important to people, right? Because you were there at a very foundational level and you're still there now doing really important work. And it just feels like something that is you. I don't know. Like, it feels like a product Mickey Vukovic would put out, which is like, and that's cool, because I think like a lot of times if you think about any kind of art, music, whatever, and you can't even look at me right now because you don't like getting praise about things like this, right? You're like, yeah, see? You're like, no, stop
it's
it.
Fine, whatever.
But I mean, that's cool. But I mean, I think like some of the, like, you know, when you're producing art, one of the best things someone can say about it is this is obviously their thing. This is a Mickey Vukovic book, which is cool. One of the things I like about it. So, I mean, anyone who's listening that's a fan, I think they should get it because it's really, really cool.
I think the biggest compliment would be that, people see me in it.
Definitely.
And a lot went through my mind as I was doing it. And, to my childhood growing up and my family and my parents and everything that they did for my brothers and I and growing up with my brothers and losing my brother, my middle brother, 2 years ago. So it all kind of, it was, kind of a process.
I didn't know. This podcast has a tendency to get personal with people. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know if or when it would be appropriate, but I did want to say I'm really sorry about Buck.
Yeah, thanks.
I'd met him a couple times playing soccer with you guys, and he was such a nice guy, and had just such a big seemingly, because I didn't really obviously know him that well, but the big personality and just so friendly to me. And like I said, I'd hardly known him, just seemed like a good guy.
Yeah, we were really shocked. But for your listeners, my brother, my middle brother, took his life two years ago, a year before last, and inexplicable,
I'm really sorry.
The book's dedicated to him, and I thought a lot about him when I was doing that, so
well, you have to run, and I just want to say that today was, so how did we start? Let's put a bow on this podcast. Mm-hmm. How did we start this morning? You were texting me at a gas station in San Clemente.
Yeah, I almost ran out of gas on my way up here.
Because you were doing what things at the same time?
I don't want the La Habra Police Department to.
Yeah, well, we're in Orange, so you're fine. Yeah,
I was trying to get up here to watch the Milan San Remo bike race, at least the end of it. Yeah. And so I actually had on my phone, I had it running, and
that's so cool.
And I was watching the road. I wasn't staring at the screen. Besides, there's a bunch of Italian commentators, whatever. So I was just kind of listening and whatever. But didn't realize that I was running out of gas and almost didn't make it.
And you almost ran out of gas in a stretch where there is no gas station because it's a military base for like 13 miles or something. Yeah,
I made it. And then we went on a great ride. And then we did this.
We ate some great vegan food. Vegan veggie.
Yeah.
Vegan and veggie.
Yeah. All accounts, a banner day.
Yeah, it was a good day. Thank you so much for coming and doing this. I've been looking forward to it for so long.
Right on. Really me too. I appreciate this. And I was just really looking forward to seeing you again.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
This was really cool.
We won't make it the last time we ride bikes together.
Yeah, let's not wait 15 years.
No, definitely not. Okay. All right, one more thing on the way out the door. How high can you count in Russian?
Googleplex. I don't know.
Thank you for being on the show, Mickey. I appreciate it. All right, thanks. Take care. All right, so that was it. That was 3 and 2 and 1 for the month of March 2016. Really appreciate you listening. If you want to check us out, Instagram and Twitter, 321 Podcast. Don't update it that much, but you can add it and check it out. More likely, you'll find me at DG After Dark at on Twitter and Instagram. Pretty active on there. And Mickey, how can people get in touch with you if they want to? They want to talk to you.
Oh, I don't know. Instagram's cool. At Mickey Vukovich, M-I-K-I-V-U-C-K-O-V-I-C-H.
Yeah. And I want to thank John Holzer, at John Holzer, of course, for editing tonight's or today's show. Really appreciate it. And yeah, we're off. Thanks so much. We'll see you next month.
Understanding we're fighting a war, we can't win. They hate us, we hate them. We can't win, no way. Take me to court for my crime. Stand in line, pay bail, and I may serve time. Understanding we're fighting a war, we can't win. They hate us, we hate them. We can't win.